This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Join us today for stories about the world's most vulnerable people and those who make a difference in their lives. On this week's program, cyclones and earthquakes. What's happening in China and Myanmar?
The truth is, though we are reaching people and saving lives, we can't reach them all. The restricted conditions here make it very, very difficult to reach them all.
Survivors of the 1994 tsunami rebuild their communities one wedding at a time. And an American businessman brings hope to Panama hat makers.
Now I have a house, a refrigerator, tables, and I pray to God to keep Brent alive and with good health so he can keep helping me this way.
Welcome to the World Vision Report. A massive earthquake hit China last Monday. The Chinese government immediately mobilized emergency rescue efforts in the stricken areas. Recovery efforts are continuing. We caught up with Kate Janis from the humanitarian aid group Mercy Corps. She told us from Chengdu what her team had seen.
It's a huge amount of loss and destruction. It's overwhelming. There's also been hundreds of aftershocks. Some have registered quite high on the Richter scale, up to 6.1. The city here, the capital, hasn't had a lot of destruction. It's largely functional. But now that the aftershocks are lessening, I think people will start reopening their businesses in the capital.
The earthquake hit at a time when most children were at school. Thousands of children are dead or missing after school buildings collapsed around them. I asked Kate Janis if China's one-child policy makes this loss especially difficult.
Yeah, if they only do have one child, that's their whole next generation. It's absolutely devastating. Some of the rural residents, actually the policy in China is if you're an ethnic minority, a lot of the areas that were hit were ethnic minority areas, you're allowed to have more than one child.
Janis says the Chinese government has been welcoming help from Western aid groups like Mercy Corps. While cleanup and rescue operations continue in China, the situation in Myanmar, formerly called Burma, is very different. The government of Myanmar has been slow to allow aid into the country. Aid has also been hampered by heavy rains that struck this week. To help us understand what's happening on the ground, we have Tim Costello on the line from Myanmar's capital city, Yangon. Tim is head of World Vision Australia. Tim, thanks so much for joining us.
That's a pleasure.
Tim, there's been a lot of focus on how hard it's been for aid workers to get in and do their work because of the military regime there. Now, I know your team with World Vision was actually working on the ground in Myanmar long before the cyclone hit. Has that given you an advantage in getting aid to victims?
Yeah, it certainly has. The fact that we have a 30-year history of working here, we're loved and respected by the communities and the government knows us. And nearly 600 workers, it's meant that we have had a very special letter from the government to make sure we get through the military clearances. That letter from a general gives us unrestricted access to the affected areas and most importantly insists that we deliver our aid, not hand it over to the military to be delivered by them.
We're not hearing reports like this. We're hearing that people are being stopped and that aid groups, foreign aid groups, are not allowed in and that in some cases money and aid is being taken from the aid groups by the military and used for other purposes.
Yes, we're hearing all those stories too. And I would say that this is the most unprecedented lack of access for a humanitarian disaster of this scale in recent history. We are working in the most narrow of narrow humanitarian spaces. We too, though we're getting our aid through thanks to that letter and the history of being in the country, nonetheless are still finding it very difficult to get visas for the World Vision experts who are foreigners, who really have fantastic expertise in water and sanitation, in health systems, in food security. We are also struggling to still get our plane full of goods and supplies in. So it's a mixed scorecard, but the great news is that we have reached over 100,000 people with our aid, and we continue to have unrestricted access within country, both buying sources of medicine, food, rice, water within country, and also now being supplied by the World Food Program with tons of rice because we are able to actually get it to the affected areas.
With so much need in front of you, are there enough groups able to meet this need? Are there any other groups who are being given this kind of access?
Look, there's only about five or six major organizations, which is very few, and the access for all of us I would describe as getting aid through a three-inch pipe that's trickling rather than a 30-foot pipe that needs to be really pumping. The truth is, though we are reaching people and saving lives, we can't reach them all. The restricted conditions here make it very, very difficult to reach them all. And that's why our deepest hope and prayer is that we might see the door open wider for foreign aid, for foreign experts, for helicopters and planes. There's been some signs of hope, glimmers rather than, full light switches being thrown. The UN has just received permission for 17 visas for foreign experts to come in. We NGOs are still waiting for our permission, but we are hoping this is a first step and that we'll get ours also. We desperately need those people because our staff are pretty exhausted. Many of them have family who are also missing in the Delta region, so they're terribly anxious and carrying those worries. That's why our staff are often in tears. They're feeling frustrated and at times even guilty that they can't reach all the people they know they should reach. So whilst we're getting aid through, it is also a very constrained political context.
Tim Costello, speaking with us from Yangon, Myanmar's capital city. Thank you so much for being with us today.
That's a pleasure.
That was Tim Costello with World Vision, an aid group which also sponsors this show. We go now from stories of disaster to a journey toward recovery. It's been more than 3 years since a tsunami struck Indonesia and swept away entire coastal communities there. Today, most survivors have new homes, and most communities have new schools and hospitals. But rebuilding after a natural disaster takes more than bricks and mortar. The spirit of the people, their culture and traditions also have to be revived. And that's not easy when women, the cornerstone of most communities, are missing. Orlando de Guzman reports from Aceh.
The village of Lambaro was once a thriving community of 600 people, wedged between the wide green paddy fields to the east and the Indian Ocean to the west. The men here mostly spent their days out at sea fishing, while the women stayed home with their children or worked in the nearby fields. When the tsunami struck Lambaro village, it left nothing standing.
I remember I flew here in the helicopter along the coast.
Peter Strauf works for the British charity Oxfam. He first saw Lambaro several weeks after the big wave.
It was still devastation. It was still honestly devastation. Like a battlefield.
Many of the men survived the tsunami because they were fishing far out at sea in deep water, safely away from the giant waves that crashed into the village. Most of the women stayed home and drowned with their children. The village lost all but 15 of its women.
Ibu Nursida, Ibu Basia,
Ibu Aminah. The women survivors in Lambaro are so few that people here can count them on their fingers using their first names.
Ibu Usna, Ibu Rukia, Ibu Moli.
An Oxfam study of the area found that male survivors outnumbered women survivors by a ratio of 3-1. Jamalia Ahmed, one of Lambaro's survivors, says she sorely misses the old village.
It's really lonely now. It's not like before when there were a lot of people, a lot of neighbors. Now there's no neighbors, no children, no relatives, nothing. It's just too quiet.
The gender imbalance among survivors has had a profound impact here, especially when it comes to marriage. Jamalia and her friends gather under the shade of a large mango tree. Despite the tragedy they went through, the topic of marriage and how villagers found their new partners brings laughter. The scarcity of women here forced survivors to be creative in their search for new mates.
Those who have lost their wives have remarried with those who have lost their husbands. It happened very early on when we were all still living together in the refugee barracks.
But for many, finding a partner is still difficult. 24-year-old Zulkarnia says there simply are no available women around.
It's really hard finding a partner here now. Not like before when there were plenty of women here. Now we have to go far away to bring women from other towns.
And that's exactly what has happened. The men take the unusual step of leaving Lambaro and courting women in faraway places, usually when someone spreads the word that there's a woman of marrying age who'd like to get married. Now Lambaro's women population is mostly from other places, and the newcomers have been accepted into the community by the surviving women. Gradually, the loneliness and quiet are giving way. Women in Lambaro are going back to work and once again teaching the Quran to their children. They're even learning the local dances and songs. Dance teacher Nazmi Hamid helps keep the local customs alive.
When it comes to the dances and other traditions, yes, I am worried. But I'm also hopeful that they won't be lost. If no one cares about these things, then they will be lost. We can save these traditions, but it will take some time.
Rebuilding the entire community will take some time, too. But bit by bit, it's happening. The villagers say that getting married and restarting a family is seen as a way of healing from the trauma. 3 years after the tsunami, I come to see Atiya Ali bin Muhammad, who I first met in a temporary shelter a few days after the tsunami hit. She had lost all three of her children. I find her in front of her new home, where she's drying pungent clove blossoms on a cement foundation, all that's left of her old house. As she speaks, her 18-month-old baby girl wakes up from a nap and comes to sit on her lap. The girl has Atiya's striking almond-shaped eyes.
Adat kami tetap adat. Kayak pokoknya kami kebiasaan kami biar.
Our traditions will always be the same here, Atiya says, no matter what change comes our way. She says the women in Lambaro will do what they've always done and raise their children like they always have. For the World Vision Report, this is Orlando de Guzman, Lambaro, Aceh, Indonesia.
Some of the finest straw hats in the world come from Ecuador. The best sell for hundreds, even thousands of dollars. Most of that money goes to hat dealers and retail stores. The weavers themselves barely survive on the money they make. One American businessman is trying to change that equation. Mary Stuckey reports from the central coast of Ecuador.
The sun has gone down in the dry, dusty village of Pile. The villagers here are settling in for the night. But work has just begun for Simón Espinal.
All my life, I've liked this job of weaving hats. And I pray to God to give me the good eyes I need to do this job well.
Espinal works in the bedroom of his house. He stands hunched over at almost a 90-degree angle. His chest rests on a block of wood. He reaches down below that and starts to work on a hat he's weaving around a circular block. This is the traditional position for weaving, and it leaves Espinal's neck and shoulders in pain. The 39-year-old weaves at night when it's cooler. That's because a single drop of sweat can ruin a hat. The process can be nerve-wracking.
When I start a hat, I'm thinking, when am I going to finish? When I finish the hat, I'm proud, but very worried while I'm weaving.
It takes 3 months of this painstaking labor to make a single hat. But, oh, what a hat. The strands of straw are so fine and are woven so tightly, it appears to be made not of straw, but of linen. They're called Panama hats because they were worn by workers who built the Panama Canal. The finest sell for mind-boggling thousands of dollars. But the weavers themselves usually make less than $2,000 a year. Even Simón Espinal, who was considered one of the finest weavers alive, even he has thought about leaving Ecuador in search of work.
I have thought of it, but then I think of my family and my children left behind in Ecuador and growing up without a father.
But now there may be a way to keep Simón Espinal home with his family, thanks to a retired advertising executive from Hawaii. Brent Black discovered Panama hats 20 years ago when he came to Ecuador on vacation. Black was amazed by the hats he saw, and he saw something else, a business opportunity that would mean some money for him and also for the weavers. He became a man on a mission.
I think it's critically important that these people have a quality of life that allows them to do their art. It would help if he's not totally consumed by hunger or something.
Black wanted to sell more hats at higher prices and at the same time pay the hat makers an equitable cut of the sale price.
That's part of what I'm trying to do, is to get people in the buying market to understand the value of the hats so that the retail prices can more closely approximate what they should be in order to generate enough for the guys who are making them.
So, Black brought high-tech marketing to this low-tech craft. Black developed a website to sell the hats.
We go to the ironing. This is a Simón hat, and when he's cutting off the excess straw, he gathers it, bundles it, and saves it. That way,
the website features beautiful photos of the hat-making process. It begins with trekking into the rainforest to cut the palm fibers that make up the hats. After the hat is woven, there's still work to be done. In fact, it has to be ironed. The men who do that are called planchadores, and the late Néstor Franco was revered as one of the best. Black clicks to a photo of Franco, who ironed the hats until they were as smooth as silk.
You can see the old iron heating in the coals. Néstor would build his fire first thing in the morning.
The hats on the website cost from about $400 to more than $10,000, depending on the fineness of the weave. A weaver can make up to 40% of that price once the hat sells. Black says one weaver received a check for a single hat that was equal to what he used to earn in an entire year. Black ships to buyers all over the world. He just sent a hat to the actor Peter O'Toole. But all this may not be enough to save the craft. Some say it's too late, that there aren't enough fine weavers left because so many have emigrated in search of better-paying jobs. Others say there aren't enough people willing to pay such high prices for hats. But for the several hundred weavers Black works with, life is getting better. Simón Espinal is one of them. He says that before he went to work for Brent Black, he sometimes didn't have enough to eat.
Now I have a house, a refrigerator, tables, and I pray to God to keep Brent alive and with good health so he can keep helping me this way.
Espinal says if Brent Black can keep selling enough of his super fine Panama hats, he'll keep making them. He'll stay in Pile with his family, bending over, patiently weaving straw into tight, tiny rows after the sun goes down. For the World Vision Report, I'm Mary Stuckey in Pile, Ecuador.
This story was produced with support from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation. You can see photos of the weavers and their hats at our website, worldvisionreport.org. This next story has details which might be upsetting to some listeners. It's about a medical condition known as obstetric fistula. That's a debilitating condition which causes women injured during childbirth to suffer from severe incontinence. Fistulas were all but wiped out in the West with the development of cesarean deliveries. But it still exists in developing countries, especially in rural areas with poor health care. In sub-Saharan Africa, as many as 3 million young women live in shame and isolation because of the condition. In Ethiopia, there's a private hospital dedicated completely to helping fistula victims. Richard Locke visited the hospital, and he brings us this story.
In the corner of a gleaming white hospital ward, several nurses prepare for their morning rounds. Rays of sun stream in through windows, bathing the room's young female patients in a warm light. It's a hushed place. Some lie motionless, tethered to an intravenous drip, staring wide-eyed at the ceiling. Others sit up in their beds, talking quietly to their neighbors.
In this big ward, we have 52 beds, and most of the patients whom you see here, they have had their operation done. Most of these women had a leakage of urine, and there are some also will have a leakage of fecal material.
Sister Ruth Gudisa is a senior nurse at the Addis Ababa Fistula Hospital. Each year, doctors here operate on 1,500 women and girls.
Most of the patients are young, because in some areas, because of early marriage, and mostly it happened on the first pregnancy.
Although virtually unheard of in the West nowadays, fistula remains widespread across sub-Saharan Africa. In Ethiopia alone, there are an estimated 150,000 cases each year. A fistula develops when the mother's bony pelvis is too small for the baby's head. The contractions squeeze to death the tissue between the bladder and birth canal, creating a hole. Typically, the baby dies, but for the mother, that's only the beginning of the suffering. Because of their physical condition, most women are abandoned by their husbands and shunned by their communities. And in a country where most women are impoverished and uneducated, fistula victims are often considered useless. Only a lucky few end up here for treatment. Outside the hospital's post-operative ward, Lubaba waits for her husband to come down from the village to collect her. She doesn't know how old she is, but she says she developed a fistula giving birth to her sixth child. Lubaba explains she was in labor for 3 days before her family took her to the nearest hospital a day away, but it was too late to save the baby. A month after her husband brought her by bus to the hospital, she's well enough to return home. Lubaba says her children are waiting for her return. They've asked many times when she's coming home. Not all women are as fortunate as Lubaba. For some, their injuries are too severe to be surgically repaired. Nestled in the hills, about 10 miles outside of Addis Ababa, is a small community run by the Fistula Hospital. Its name, Destamender, means Joy Village. 54 women live here in bungalows that surround a garden filled with roses and rhododendrons. Since surgery didn't repair their fistulas, they're now fitted with colostomy bags. 22-year-old Sahe is one of the women who lives here. Sitting under a tree, she remembers her arranged marriage.
I got married at the age of 8 and lived with my husband's family. 4 years later, I had my first period and slept with my husband for the first time and fell pregnant.
After 6 days in labor, Sahe's baby boy was stillborn. Her father took her to the nearest hospital, 2 days' walk away, but the doctors said there was nothing they could do to repair her fistula.
I was unable to control my urine and feces. They told my father to take me to Addis Ababa, but my father said he couldn't afford transport costs, so he took me back home.
Sahe endured 8 years of suffering, most of the time curled up on a soaked mattress in her father's house. She finally received care when the government offered fistula sufferers in her area a one-off journey to the capital. Beletek Bedada is the head nurse at Joy Village. She paints a grim picture of the women's state of mind when they first come here.
They think they lost their respect in the society. They know they will never get their marriage life again. They will not carry baby in their life because of the organs destructed.
So Joy Village tries to help them rebuild their broken self-esteem and establish an independent life. The hope is they'll eventually leave the community and be able to earn an income. So the residents also learn job skills like livestock rearing and tailoring. In a bedroom she shares with 5 other women, 20-year-old Mezelech sits at a table piled high with fabric, learning how to stitch with a sewing machine.
When I arrived, I didn't know how to sew, but now I am learning how to make a skirt with a machine. In the future, I will be able to make clothes for people and earn money.
The residents also receive psychological counseling throughout their time at Joy Village, but it's a long road to physical and emotional recovery. Sahe doesn't know when the doctors will allow her to return home. For now, the biggest prize for this young woman is to be able to socialize again, if only with the others.
Now I'm fine. I can mix with other people. Thanks to God, everything is okay now.
The hospital hopes to have four clinics open in different corners of the country. If the women are able to live close by, they'll be able to continue receiving the healthcare and emotional support they need. Then, Joy Village need never be a permanent home. For the World Vision Report, I'm Richard Locke in Joy Village, Ethiopia.
In Kenya, thousands of orphans take care of younger siblings. Reporter Richard Locke recently met one of them in the fishing village of Osenge on the shores of Lake Victoria. 17-year-old Evans Odiambalo was stepping out of a wooden canoe, clutching two small fish, when he spoke with Richard. Both of Evans' parents were HIV positive. Their deaths left Evans responsible for caring for his two brothers. So he left school and now works on the beach for a dollar a day.
My name is Evans Odhiambo. I'm live in Osenge. My old is 17 years old.
I'm 17 years old. My father died in March 2003. My mom used to take him to the hospital. They say he died of HIV. And my mother died this year, in April 2006. Even my mother died of HIV. At home, people deserted us, so we don't have anyone to lean on. The whole responsibility is on me, and it's hard. That's why I've come here to find something we can live on. I won't say it's bad, but at least I can work. The little I get, I can sit down and say, this one I take for my brother, maybe for his education. This one I keep for myself, and this one I can use for other things, maybe clothes. But it's not enough. Whatever I do, it's not enough. But we get by. I don't feel good with my parents. They never took responsibility and kept themselves safe against AIDS. If they had taken their lives seriously, maybe we wouldn't be facing these problems. So I'm not happy about it, about them, because now we are suffering for no good reason. If they were responsible, they would still be here to take good care of us. I want to take care of myself, of my good life, so I don't succumb to that calamity, AIDS.
That was 17-year-old Evans Odiambalo, in his own words. That brings us to the end of our show. If you'd like to know more about our program, visit our website, worldvisionreport.org. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.